Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really matter. Coming up on the program, criticism mounts over the Health Minister's new hiring plan. We'll be talking to the Minister. The way forward for South Africa after the global sell-off. Philanthropists are donating 1.8 billion rand to universities amid global funding uncertainty. But the question, though, is this going to help? And biotechnology is evolving, but is South Africa being left behind? It's Monday, the 14th of April. We'll get to all of that in just a moment, but let's start with a quick item of breaking news. President Ramaphosa has just appointed the former Deputy Finance Minister, Mabisi Jonas, as his special envoy to the United States. In a statement released just a short time ago, the President said Jonas will, and I quote, represent South Africa's diplomatic, trade and investment priorities in Washington, engaging with U.S. officials and private sector leaders. It's important to note this is not a replacement for the Ambassador Ibrahim Rasool, who you'll remember was asked to leave by the Trump administration. Here's Vincent Magwenya, who speaks for the presidency.
This appointment underscores Mr. Jonas's distinguished career and continued commitment to advancing South Africa's national and economic interests. For decades, South Africa and the United States of America have maintained a historical and strategic relationship. In the interest of our country, our region, and the rest of our continent, President Ramaphosa remains committed to rebuilding and maintaining this relationship for more decades on the basis of mutual respect, recognition of each other's sovereignty, and benefit for our respective peoples.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa's public healthcare system is under the microscope again. The health department announcing the hiring of around 1,650 doctors and healthcare workers, but with over 1,800 medical professionals still unemployed. Critics say this could be a political gesture, not a real fix. Nurses' unions today have slammed the plan. They've called it insulting, the minister himself admitting that the sector's HR policies are overdue for reform. So I'm in conversation now with the health minister, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi. Minister, welcome and thank you very much indeed. The hiring that you've announced is all well and good, but yet over 1,800 doctors remain jobless. I guess the opening question here is, to what extent are you really fixing the problem?
Well, look, the 1,800 is a media number, Jeremy, and the media is stuck into it. At the beginning of this year, when this whole saga about marches and all that happened, the figure of 1,800 was a figure given after checking the number of doctors who completed community service. At that time, posts were advertised and not filled. At least 550 posts were advertised and they are going to be filled. It has got nothing to do with the announcement we made last week. It was the only money that was available then for 550 posts. Then last week on Thursday, during the press conference, we announced that we have got money again for 1,200. And then every time the media ask us, but there are 1,800, others even put them at 2,000. I don't know anywhere, Jeremy, in the world where you, when you put up the budget or hire people, you are able to count everybody who's unemployed. We put that money because that's the amount of money we have. That's the amount of money Treasury gave us. If you listen very well to the Minister of Finance, during when he read the budget speech, he said he's giving us money to hire 800 doctors. I had to negotiate hard with him to put the figure at 1,200. in terms of the money we have. So it's the money that controls everything and nothing else.
So, Minister, how many doctors then will still remain jobless based on the figures that you've just given me?
I do not know, Jeremy, because some doctors went into private practice. They are now applying back to the So I wouldn't know, because some had gone out of the country. They are coming back. We don't keep such lists. We are just advertising jobs and say, here are the adverts and please come in.
There is a sense, though, that the state is still rationing medical jobs in a country, Minister, that is desperate for bigger or greater public healthcare capacity. Is that an unfair assertion?
Yes, it's unfair, because the state is rationing everything depending on its budget. It's rationing the number of roads which will be built, the number of schools, the number of hospitals, the number of teachers it can hire, the number of police, the number in the army, the number of social workers, the amount of money paid to old age pensioners. All of it is rationing in terms of what is there in the budget. I believe that's exactly how countries are run. You do things in terms of you cut the suit according to the size of the cloth you are having at that present moment in time.
And that is having an impact, surely, on the ability of the state to deliver optimum healthcare.
Well, it will have impact of the state, not only on healthcare, on everything. We have gone through austerity for 10 years, and austerity means cutting expenditure, especially for social services. The minister says he's trying to reverse it, and I don't think it's reasonable to believe that he can reverse it in one budget or in 1 year. If you look at the amount of money announcing the parliament, he gave us 29 billion over 3 year period, not in 1 year. If it was given in 1 year, then we'll have been very far. That is over 3 years. And so you take that 29 billion, you divide it by three, and you see what you can do. Remember, when we announced there on Thursday, we did not only announce hiring of people. We also announced other services that are needed by the public, not only human resources, the buying of certain things. We are going to announce the payment of service providers for blood, oxygen, pharmaceuticals, and that. All that money is going to be rationed in a way that it will pay for all those things.
Minister, today the Democratic Nursing Organization has expressed disappointment with the announcement that you're only going to recruit 200 nurses into the system. They say that 20,000 trained nurses remain unemployed. They've called your plan insulting. What do you say to the union?
Well, I'm not insulting anybody, Jeremy. I'm just rationing in terms of the money I've got. That's all I'm doing. I'm not trying to insult anybody. I'm also very disappointed, by the way. If I was given three times or four times what I'm given now, I wouldn't be hiring fewer people. I would have increased the number four times or even more. This is according to the money that has been given to me by Treasury.
Minister,
and that's all I'm able to do.
Minister, you've also admitted, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you've criticized current human resource policies, which I think you've said are outdated. What do you mean by that? And if that's the case, why has it taken so long to act?
I am not criticizing them. We have just said, and we believe it's time to review them. The reason is that a number of the human resource policies for health were devised and designed at a different time in the history of the country. In 1994, things are completely different. Some of the policies, because I'm a doctor, I worked in public hospitals, some of the policies are no longer applicable. For instance, during my time, we used to run a hospital alone, one doctor, all alone running a particular hospital. You will find no such a hospital again in this country, which is run by one doctor. The hospital which I used to run alone in Skukuni has got more than 50 doctors now. During my time, it was one. So you can't apply a policy to 50 doctors, which was implemented when only there was one doctor. Those are some of the things we want to change. And so if you give me time, I can name them and tell you why they must change or why we want them reviewed. But that's the general view, that they were implemented at the time when things were different from what they are now.
So, Minister, you are hiring, and this is the last question to you, you are hiring, albeit against a backdrop of some criticism. Are there metrics then that are going to prove that your plan is working? And when do you hope you can see results?
Well, if you hire 1,200 doctors, it will definitely make a difference to the system. There's no way. It won't solve all your problem, but there's no way you can say hiring of 1,200 doctors doesn't bring any difference whatsoever. It will. The question is how much. That's what, by how much, we don't know. If you hire nurses also 200, it's true what Inosa is saying, that they are disappointed, but I'm not insulting them. It's the money that they've been given. And if I'm given more, I'll definitely hire more.
I'm going to leave it there. That's the Health Minister, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as global markets reel from tariff shocks and recession fears mount in the United States, the ripple effects are being felt here at home. From risks to South African exports to uncertainty around the government of national unity, the pressure is certainly on. And my question today is South Africa ready for what is coming, or are we maybe sleepwalking into a storm? I'm going to talk to Chris Holdsworth, who's the Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment International, also the voice behind the Macro Monday briefings. Chris, a very warm welcome. And very bluntly, in your opinion, how exposed is South Africa if these US tariffs persist?
Yeah, we are exposed in certain ways. I think there's a couple of points worthy of consideration. The first is we don't know if the tariffs are going to persist. Over the past week, we've seen three material adjustments to tariff policy out of the US, and there may well be further sizable adjustments over the coming few weeks. So we can't fully answer the question because we don't yet know what the question is. We don't yet know what the tariff policy is going to be. It's probably going to take about a month or two to settle down as a starting point. The second point, though, is a lot of what South Africa exports are things that the US cannot easily produce, commodities. And those commodities, up until now, have been exempt from the tariffs that the US is imposing. So a large portion of South African exports actually are unaffected. There's a much smaller portion, and particularly related to agriculture and vehicle manufacturing, which is affected. And for that, those two sectors in particular, there would be a sizable knock, and there's no easy way around that. We could try other markets around the globe, but the rest of the world is going to attempt to do that. So for those sectors in particular, I would say that there certainly is some risk, but we can't yet quantify it.
You're suggesting, though, that a lot of the risk is simply in the opaqueness, in the uncertainty. And how then does South Africa navigate around that? And again, in a similar position, I imagine, to many other countries.
Similar to all the other countries. I mean, we sit within that bucket of countries that now has a 10% tariff, and the US is asking to negotiate with each of those countries. And we have no clarity at all as to what the intention is. It seems that the guideline from the US administration has been that they would like a neutral trade balance with all countries. That would be quite difficult for countries that are relatively poor, like South Africa or like Lesotho. I mean, how can we afford to increase our imports of goods out of the US? It could be quite difficult to achieve. So there might be other things that we have to give up in some form of negotiation, or it might be the case that we land up with a tariff of 10%. But it's very difficult to say at this point. We first have to see the negotiations and then some guidelines to what they're looking to settle on.
And overlaying or overarching this problem, Chris, is the risk which continues this week about a collapse of South Africa's government of national unity.
You know, there is an extra layer of SA-specific risk, which has actually seen the rand weaken relative to other emerging market currencies that themselves weakened against the dollar in this environment of heightened political uncertainty in the US and globally. And it makes it very difficult for South Africa because it has real-world consequences. When the rand weakens, the Reserve Bank takes note, and it may well hinder their ability to cut rates. As an example, it also leads to higher inflation, and there's other knock-on consequences too. So there are certainly real-world consequences of heightened political uncertainty, and as soon as those could be addressed, we may well see some form of reprieve, at least relative to other EMs. But short of that, it is likely to weigh on our market.
So fair to say then that investor confidence in South Africa is in danger possibly of cracking over all the political noise. And that means that it's going to become incrementally more difficult for this country to attract capital with all the global uncertainty rising.
I'd say that's a fair characterization. There's an extra point to add, though. South Africa already trades at a pretty sizable discount to other emerging markets and to developed markets. As an example, our stock market trades on a forward PE of around 10, and the US is on a forward PE of 19. Our bond yields traded between 10 to 11%, depending on the day that you're looking at them. US bond yields are trading between 4 and 4.5%. So there's a lot of risk premium already priced into South African assets. And so the bad news to some degree has been priced in very low expectations for South Africa. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that we are completely insulated from any risk-off concerns. We would be moving in line with the rest of the globe, but bearing in mind that there is a margin of safety here at least.
So you talk about looking for other markets, and maybe if Europe surprises us on growth when numbers are out, is there a realistic chance that we could aggressively pivot our trade strategy away from the United States?
I think the starting point is to recognize that Europe is a much bigger trading partner for us than the United States, much bigger. And should it be the case that we see an acceleration of European growth, that would be massively important for South African exports and go some way in offsetting the aggregate effect of increased tariffs in the US. But I think you've hit the nail on the head here. If it is the case that Europe is able to accelerate, that goes some way in bailing out SA and a whole range of other countries. The difficulty is going to be for European growth to actually accelerate in an environment where US growth is decelerating. That's very unusual.
And Chris, just a final one then. We know that US bond markets are currently flashing red. How is this going to affect South Africa? And should the Reserve Bank be strategizing or planning or even bracing for increased capital flight?
I'm sure it's something that they look at on a regular basis, and I'm sure it's something that they're considering at the moment. But the US has that issue themselves. What's happened is that we've seen a widespread withdrawal of investors from US assets, equities, fixed income, and the dollar themselves have all weakened at the same time, which is very unusual by itself. It is a problem for a country like South Africa because our interest rates typically take their cue from US rates along with other emerging markets. And so in the case that US yields do go up, naturally, it puts upward pressure on our yields. I wouldn't say that that would automatically by itself lead to capital flight out of SA, but it does certainly lead to a valuation concern in SA. We end up with higher yields, and that means higher discount rates. It makes it much more difficult for companies to beat their cost of capital. And these are all things that would land up in the mix for the local market.
I appreciate the assessment. That's Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment. Chris, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, at a time when South African universities are buckling under funding pressure, philanthropists have seemingly stepped in, donating a record 1.8 billion rand in 2022 alone. But can private giving sustainably fill the gaps left by declining state support as far as tertiary institutions are concerned? I'm going to explore that issue with Ferial Domingo from Inyatelo, the South African Institute for Advancement, with insights from their latest Philanthropy in Higher Education report. Ferial, a very warm welcome. So 1.8 billion rand in donations sounds impressive, but the question is it enough to meaningfully shift the funding crisis that faces so many universities in this country?
Jeremy, I don't think so, but I think the report demonstrates there's an increasing effort by these higher education institutions, and so the success rate is also shifting. So we have seen over the span of the research that's been done over 10 years, the significant shifts from the baseline study that was conducted in 2013. So I think we're not out of the woods, but I certainly can tell you there isn't any evidence of a declining situation.
Which is good news. In terms of the way in which the money is used, Ferial, if I've read this correctly, nearly half of donations go to student funding. Is that money then reducing dropout rates? And we have a big problem in that respect in this country, or even student debt?
I think universities are making tremendous efforts to provide assistance to students, right? And I think we've seen it all over the media, especially the first quarter of the university's financial year, that there is evidence that universities are making great efforts. I think there's still a lot of work to be done. There's still a huge student debt. But as I say, everyone's making the effort to reduce that. You've just quoted that there's almost close to 50% of investment is going into student funding, right? Mm. Now, when we did the previous report last year, the report was on the COVID years, only 30% of funding went to student funding because donors were directing their money towards infrastructure, providing support for health research, etc. So I'm happy to see that shifted from 30 to 50, or it's close to 50. I think the number was 47%. But yeah, so we've seen that has also shifted. And so that for me is evidence that there is more effort made to provide students with the kind of, or the level of funding they need
and Ferial,
to stay in tertiary.
Also critical that the money that is donated is managed judiciously. Are universities ensuring that this donor money either isn't mismanaged or perhaps even worse, just lost in bureaucracy and not used efficiently?
It's hard to say for me. We don't really do research on how they manage their administration, but I don't, and I certainly cannot provide you with any evidence to the contrary. I would like to think that the institutions that we're dealing with, who are part of the research, have very tight systems in place. Remember, when you're reporting to donors, even that system itself is very, very tight. And so, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be successful the next time around if you're not able to provide the evidence that you have done what you agreed to do with the money. And so I guess, you know, in everywhere in the world, I guess there is things that fall through the crack. But from my perspective, my understanding is that things are managed very tightly.
Unsurprisingly, Ferial, the report shows strong local support. That would be expected, I guess. But international donation is still limited, and there is a wide net of South African alumni abroad.
Yes, and the advancement offices have increased the systems and the way they approach alumni outside of South Africa. We've seen in this report the individual donors now make up almost 71% of the total donor pool of this research in 2022. So that tells us that they are reaching more individual donors. And an individual donor is an alumni as well, right? Ultimately, one hopes that alumni provides access to more corporate funding or more foundation funding, wherever they may have access to. So we've seen that increase in the individual donors. So it is literally, as I said, an encouraging trend. We've seen that growth over the number of years as well.
Are there safeguards in place to prevent donors from exerting influence over academic or institutional priorities? This is often a worldwide problem.
It is, and I must agree with you. You know, not just for universities, but also on the NPO sector. We have experienced that there is a level of influence that sometimes they wish to pose or impose on the grantees, if we want to just give it a general term. But I think the landscape has shifted. There has to be respect for both parties. We know our business. You know yours. We are the intervention. We know how it's done. And as you build up, and I think, Jeremy, this has a lot to do with how you're cultivating that relationship to the point where you're invited to submit a proposal. And so I think in that cultivation is where the two parties get to know each other really well, to the point where you're able to say, no, this is what we want to do.
Are you concerned that top institutions or prestige institutions get the lion's share of the donor funding? It would suggest surely that we're not entrenching, or we could be entrenching, inequality between universities. Again, I imagine a universal issue.
Again, I want to agree. There's a big concern that the top universities continues to attract, I would almost want to say it appears, with less effort. But I don't think that is the case. Again, remember, we want to make sure that all universities attract the kind of funding that they need. But they also need to be seen to be the kind of universities that donors want to align themselves with. So everyone, I think, wants to support best in class. And so one hopes that through other mechanisms, in the way that there's now CETA sectoral education and training of funding available, that there's more effort in finding your individual donors, that doesn't happen in the future. But I would think, because it is a universal problem, it will probably continue.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Ferial Domingo from Inyatelo, the South African Institute for Advancement. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, biotechnology is reshaping healthcare right across the globe, from personalized medicine and stem cell therapy to genetic diagnostics and also regenerative treatments. But how much of the future is actually accessible here in Africa? As this country navigates a tough economic climate, constrained public health budgets and limited innovation funding, there are companies like Next Biosciences that are testing what is really possible. But behind the accolades that the company is receiving, I think there's a much tougher conversation to be had. Some key questions here. Can we scale biotech innovation in South Africa beyond niche markets? And what systemic barriers still stand in our way? Important questions, and I'm going to put some of those to Dr. Yvonne Holt, who's Chief Medical Officer and co-founder of Next Biosciences. Yvonne, a very warm welcome, and I want to start with the big picture. South Africa, we know, has world-class scientists, but limited biotech infrastructure. Why is the sector, in your opinion, still so underdeveloped?
I think the bottom line is funding for the sector. Biotechnology, any advanced medical technologies are expensive. It does require a lot of funding. The therapies that are developed are expensive. And our healthcare sector, and I think our research academic sector, does not have the funding needed to really expand this industry.
Yvonne, is it a lack of money completely, or just a reluctance to invest in an industry where there might not be huge returns in the early stages?
I think it's a bit of both, particularly, and I'm not talking about technology in other industries, it's really just in health. We have so many other health priorities in our country that draw a lot of the funds that are available. You know, we're still grappling with infectious disease. We are still, grappling with HIV, diarrhea, TB. So funding is kind of drawn into managing those programs. So advanced biotech that perhaps is not going to reach the greater population is then put on the back burner.
It's also the greater population maybe that is a problem, because your organization is a successful biotech business from what I understand, but you must be asking yourself questions all the time about whether it is scalable in a country where most patients simply can't afford advanced healthcare.
Yeah, so our business has been successful. We have been around now for 20 years. However, it remains small, and we only reach a small private market in South Africa. Obviously, we'd love to expand to, you know, the government healthcare hospitals. We have genetic testing, particularly in the reproductive space, that would benefit those patients. But that genetic testing, as it is all over the world, is expensive. It is very pricey, and our healthcare system just cannot afford it at the moment.
How difficult is it also to navigate the regulatory environment? Is it enabling innovation, or does it stifle it?
No, I think the regulatory environment has evolved greatly over the last 20 years. And SAHPRA is definitely committed to enable this industry, enable products to come to market. So I must say, we haven't found it difficult with the regulatory government in, say, the last year or two. They've definitely evolved since 2005, when we started.
So in order for biotech then to become a national priority, what, in your opinion, needs to happen in the short to medium term? And I guess it will be both a political and economic question.
Yeah. So To start with, we do have great young scientists, I must say, fantastic minds that are coming out of our universities, but we are losing them internationally simply because the biotech industry is bigger there. So what we would need here is funding for research projects, expansion into commercializing inventions that come up through the universities, and we need support from medical aids to support payment of, say, these treatments, of these tests. And then also, you know, government involvement or funding, if we can sort out our healthcare sector, because I absolutely understand that they have these other priorities. So if we can sort out the healthcare sector, there will be extra space and funding for a biotechnology innovations.
What I'm also hearing, though, is potentially a very large clock that is ticking, because the biotech market in Africa often overshadowed by Western countries and also
yes.
Asia. So you would need a better strategy, surely, a more cohesive strategy to make sure that Africa isn't just a user, but a generator of biotech IP.
Well, exactly. And if more companies like ours can see the value in that, I mean, I think we've also got to change the narrative that Africa can't afford it, Africa can't do it. We absolutely can, and is to find the will to set up more biotech companies, use our African IP, because there is IP in Africa, collaborate with the West and the East. I mean, collaborating with the West now may be a little more difficult with all these tariffs and things that are going on. So, you know, the East also has unbelievable tech, and they are willing to collaborate. And, you know, to start up companies here in South Africa, there is a market, and we need to try and create more of a market and perhaps bring cheaper technology here. Technology from the West is very expensive. But if we look to the East, they are willing to negotiate on better pricing. So what I'm saying is there is hope, and there are ways that we can manage this and develop an industry here in South Africa.
And I'm going to leave it there. Dr. Yvonne Holt, thank you very much indeed. Chief Medical Officer, co-founder of Next Biosciences. I do appreciate your time. And that brings our program to a close. That's MoneyWeb at midday for today. Please join us again tomorrow. We are live at noon, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.